And welcome. Today, we're really excited to have a conversation with Dr. Gloria Gonzalez Morales, an associate professor of psychology and director of the Worker Wellbeing Lab at Claremont Graduate University. We've been engaging in conversation with Dr. Gloria for probably a little bit over a year, really excited about her research on oppressive civility and for us. As leadership educators talking about her journey. So welcome, Gloria. And
thank you.
Tell us a little bit about who you are and what you do.
Thank you so much for inviting me. This is such a great opportunity. There's very few opportunities to be able to have a conversation with kind of like friends, like it's really early in the morning, but maybe a glass of wine and discussing these issues. I arrived to the States back in 2007 as a Fulbright visiting scholar. I'm originally from Canary Islands. Those are some islands on the west coast of Africa that actually are part of Spain. Our culture and our experiences are sometimes more closer to Latino experiences than people from Spain in the mainland. So that's one of the reasons why, you know, I really like have an identity as a Latinx person here in the States. My accent in Spanish is like Venezuelan or Cuban, and I love salsa, I dance, there's all these shared cultural elements that make me feel at home here in Southern California and also in Tucson, that is my other home. So I came here, I was doing research on work and life conflict. I was doing a lot of research on stress from a feminist perspective. And then I moved to Canada after 2 or 3 years. And I was there for 10 years as a professor. And then I decided to come down to Claremont. It's in the very, very limit of Los Angeles County. So I don't see the ocean from my window, but I see beautiful mountains. And here I came here because it's a graduate university where I can work one-on-one with a lot of grad students. And also they have a program on positive psychology. And that's what I'm really passionate about, is about how we can think about ways that people can flourish and ways that people can figure out ways of having fulfilling lives within the workplace, because I'm more focused on organizational psychology, but also in relationship to their personal lives. So I have always been interested on well-being from a critical and feminist perspective. And that's why I have all these critical system levels ways of thinking about, for example, incivility and how we came with this idea of, well, maybe it's sometimes it's incivility and sometimes it's oppressive civility. So that's a little bit of a snippet of where I'm from, what I'm doing, and where I'm going.
So when we're looking through that lens of incivility moving towards oppressive incivility, can you talk a little bit about your personal leadership style and your own philosophy?
Yeah, so right now I feel like I'm a leader in two different aspects of my work. Like I want to give you a little bit of context of what I do here. So first is I'm the principal investigator or the director of my research lab. It's a worker well-being lab. We decided worker well-being because it really is WW, and we really wanted to call it the Wonder Women Lab, but it wasn't very like academic. So we're like, okay, let's call it worker well-being because it's really about the well-being of everybody, and then let's have the W's as an internal joke. We have a very well-established feminist identity, but an intersectional feminist identity within the lab. And so right now I lead around 15 PhD students, and then another 5 grad students are thinking out about doing the PhD. Mm-hmm. And it has been an interesting journey, because I established the lab at the beginning with 5 students. They were feeling like very cozy. They felt that this was a very safe environment. And this is where I want to talk about my leadership style. And I do that also. I try to be a leader in my learning communities when I teach as well. I use language as a tool to kind of create an understanding of what we're talking about. So in my classes, I call them learning communities. There's no students and professors. There's instructional teams and community learners or community members. Mm-hmm. And we try to build together the knowledge. I always talk about how the instructional team, that is the TA and me as the professor, are really facilitators of knowledge, and how everybody brings their identities, their thoughts into the table, and that we want to have conversations to have some kind of grasping in our own experiences to understand the academic readings that we go through. So that's one example of how I use language to try to transform a little bit the way that we think about a classroom that could be very hierarchical, mm-hmm. to a more flatter structure within a classroom. In terms of the lab, it was interesting because, yeah, when we started, everybody felt it was mostly women. It was all women, and they were like, yeah, we want to keep it tight. We want to keep it small because this feels so safe.
Yes.
And it feels such a place, such a great place to be able to collaborate and to develop trust with each other. And I was like, yeah, that's great. But we cannot be exclusive in our own inclusion. Mm-hmm. We cannot be exclusive and say, no, you cannot be part of this club, because this is where, you know, it's a tension that we are dealing with all the time, that inclusion, exclusion, right? Mm-hmm. So little by little, I was kind of creating this place where people would feel safe and brave. I love that kind of language. It comes from intergroup dialogue. Michigan. It's a pedagogical orientation I'm trying to get. I'm getting trained on that. Awesome. And this idea of safe and brave, that really in terms of psychology is just psychological safety. And we know from evidence in research that psychological safety, especially in teams, is what really allows teams to succeed, flourish, and deal with mistakes, learn from mistakes, and further develop. Mm-hmm. So I really put a lot of work on maintaining that psychological safety, or that safe and brave space, as we were adding people to our team, to our lab. Mm-hmm. Now we have a more diverse lab, because I didn't have anything, you know, I loved that my lab was all women, but I really wanted other people to come in and to experience a safe and brave space, and to be able to have all those complex conversations, so we can grow from that and we are not in an echo chamber. So little by little, we have been adding people. Mm-hmm. We have an older white dude. Sorry, Soren, that I'm calling you that, but but you know, he is great. He's from he's Dutch, and his wife is from India, I believe, and he has a lot of experience in companies and organizations and in the startups. So the perspectives that he brings to the table is still respecting and contributing to that safe and brave space are invaluable, right? Like, it's kind of like, I don't know what the lab would be without him now. Right. I have done a lot of work of trying to recruit a lot of different people, BIPOC, Fox, into the team. So now every time we have a lab meeting, it's beautiful.
Yeah.
You know, all the diversity that you see in there is beautiful, and we have privileged identities, mm-hmm. and identities that don't have that much privilege. And I think that that's what really allows us to have a good community where we can learn from each other. And at some point, I will talk about oppressive civility. But I've been talking a lot of very different things. And then the other leadership role that I have at the university right now, and I only started it, I started some of it last year, but now I'm the director of the Center for Academic and Faculty Excellence. The acronym is CAFE, and the idea is that it really is a place for people to come together to create community just after the pandemic, to be able to have those discussions about what it means to be an excellent a professor or a mentor, or for our grad students, how can they develop into scholars and faculty. So one of the things that I'm doing is, again, using language. I try to talk about established faculty and emergent faculty. So I don't just a juxtaposition between faculty and students in the, in that space. Mm-hmm. We're trying to also talk about, instead of students, because they're grad students, we talk about scholars as much as we can, to kind of like give them more agency and feeling like more autonomous, and actually deal with that imposter syndrome that all of them know, but most of them have. Mm-hmm. So that's another example how we're trying to create community with that language, and then events where, you know, there's creating opportunities for exchange. But the challenge is how you do that in a way that still is a safe and brave space, because I think that that's the key for being able to lead to real civil and meaningful interactions instead of what I call oppressive civility. Mm-hmm. That is a way of incivility that looks very civil. It looks very kind, is disguised as kindness and professionalism, but behind it, there's really an intention to put you in your place. And that's what I call oppressive civility. Mm-hmm. It's like an email that is backhanded. Yes. It's a comment at the end of a very positive email that it really tells you that, you know, they're trying to enact their power over you or their hierarchy over you. Mm-hmm. It's a type of phenomenon that also is very hard to then report.
Right.
Because on the surface, it's a very civil encounter. But the surface is not everything. You have to think about the context. And when you think about the context, you can tell that. And if we want to talk about this a little bit more, I can talk to you about this meaning of civility, especially for indigenous cultures, like how, you know, the word of civility or civilized actually has a lot of baggage. It's a negative word, and how maybe we need to change a little bit the discourse when we're talking about incivility in workplaces or about harassment or about these things. Like I sometimes think about maybe we need to talk about disrespectful behavior, rudeness. I like the idea of talking more about microaggressions, because mm-hmm. it really is talking about the experience of the person that is victimized, and not so much what the person that is victimizing or the enactor is can claim that they're doing.
Right, right. And I love just coming to a point where you're honest, right? It's not coded language.
Yeah.
You're being microaggressive. You're being disrespectful.
Yes.
You know, I think that's where some of the language, as we talk about the importance of language and Wonder Woman, and, you know, trying to replicate this safe space and brave environment.
Mm-hmm.
Language holds so much. And for some BIPOC leaders, trying to learn the language of the oppressor is part of being able to get into, unfortunately, that oppressive environment. But how do you change if you're not there at the table?
Exactly. And that's the problem with the table. Yes. We need to rebuild that. We have to take out that table and put another table that is not based on an heteropatriarchal hierarchical system, right? Like the hierarchy is what we talk about, like it's not only the patriarchal force, it's all the oppression and privilege forces that actually shape our systems.
Right.
So how can we create a new table? And this is one of the things that in the last 10 years, because I started doing a stress and gender, right? Like, and, you know, gender roles and how women tend to cope with the stress and how men tend to cope with the stress. And I remember when I was a tiny baby doctoral student thinking like that when men use social support, what I was finding in my research is that when men use social support, they actually report also higher levels of distress than when women use social support coping. And I was like, what is going on? Is that, and I thought I had two hypotheses that I wrote in the discussion of my dissertation that were like, well, maybe one is that like two hypotheses to further develop and to figure and understand what was going on is like, one is that they're using social support when it's too late, when they have tried everything. And then now they're using social support, but at this point, there's not much to be done. And that's when also there's a tendency, we also know that men or male presenting identities tend to use more escape and avoidance and even addiction as a way to cope with problems. And I think it's because, you know, there's a point where social support is not working. Well, I think that's what I was hypothesizing. But also the other reason why maybe there's a high relationship between social support and feeling distress is because when men, and I'm talking men, I'm talking in binary ways, but of course, you know, like I'm just, my research back then was very binary. when men enact social support, people are not expecting, enact that social support seeking, people are not expecting that, and they are not ready to provide that support because they are showing weakness. They're showing that they cannot do it. And then the context, maybe in organizations, doesn't allow that to happen. And then what they may get is backlash from doing that. Like we know, for example, when men ask for paternity leaves or for time off to be able to take care of their children, not babysit the children, take care of their children. This is another one that the language is important. They are told they receive backlash, supervisors are not that supportive, and they maybe also pass on promotions or bonuses. So there's all these issues around men being the receivers of this toxic masculinity as well. So I remember that, you know, yeah, back then when I was a baby dissertationer, having these thoughts about like, what is the organization? How the organization, how our culture responds to this. But then I continue working on work and life or work family conflict. And I was just really focused on that gender issue, right? And then I started to think about, well, gender is not who we are only, it's who we are within a context. And that's when I started to kind of piece things together. So we were working on incivility and harassment in the workplace. Then we were, so that was kind of like less related to gender, but related to minorities, right? Because we know that there's selective incivility. And selective incivility is a term coined by Lilia Cortina, Dr. Lilia Cortina at the University of Michigan. Yeah, Michigan is coming up a lot. that she said, she talked about how the reason why minorities experience more incivility is because that's the way that now, like, they are targeted. It's like similar to what it was conceptualized as aversive racism or implicit racism, right? Like that people are not openly racist anymore. People are not openly sexist anymore, but there's benevolent racism, there's benevolent sexism. And these type of things are showing up, for example, in that type of selective incivility. So for example, being passed for a promotion because you just have two little kids at home and they assume that you will not be able to deal with the responsibilities of the job, and you're not even asked if you're interested in the job, right? Like, and they're like, well, but we're taking care of you. Yeah, so the benevolent sexism, the aversive racism really is getting that form of selective incivility, or even that oppressive civility that we were talking about, that on the surface is very respectful, but there's or in the surface is nothing. It's just a civil encounter, but it really has in the back an intention. And when, if you don't look at the identity of the people that are interacting in that instance, it's very hard to understand what's going on. But another thing that it was interesting about doing research on gender and trying to figure out how we can get women and women of color into leadership positions was when I listened to a talk from Jennifer Burdell, who's a sociologist, University of British Columbia, but I can double check that, talking about how the problem we have tried to fix women or the leadership women issue with so many things. Like, we have tried to tell women to be more like men.
Right.
We have tried to tell women to network only with women. We have tried to tell women to lean in. There's even another book that is Lean Out.
Right?
Like, there's all these things that women have to do.
Yep.
And Jennifer Burdell was saying, well, it doesn't matter what you do, it's clearly not working. Because the gender gap and the gender wage gap and the gender leadership gap is not closing anytime soon. I think that we need like 70 or 100 years at the pace that we're going. It's about the context. And we are in organizations, that are organizations and institutions and societies that are funded in this heteropatriarchal, racist, oppressive cultures. And when we are, our deepest assumptions about culture are ingrained and rooted in that system, then you can do little changes, and some organizations, you can change some norms, but until we don't really change that culture, nothing can happen. And I remember being at that talk thinking, oh no, like, changing culture is the most difficult thing. And that someone can do in an organization. So I was really like dismayed about it. And then I came across this other author who's fantastic, Joyce Fletcher. And, it's a study that she did in the 90s, where she went to an IT company in the 90s that you wouldn't believe it, but I learned this last week also. In the 80s and the 90s, there were more women in IT than now. So she actually was able to, it has been going down in the industry. She was able to shadow and to do an ethnography with women in this women who were leaders in this IT organization. So she will shadow them, be with them, figure out what was going on, and then having conversations with them afterwards, like, oh, I noticed that in this case that you were running the meeting, you actually took responsibility for the mistakes of others, or you took this and you created this opportunity for learning, but saving face for all your team members that were men. Like, so they had conversations about what was going on there. Her paper is beautiful because she talks about all the different ways that these women leaders do what she calls relational practice and relational leadership. That is about putting the team and the collective and the community that they're leaders for first, and focusing on creating team, focusing on developing each other, and how all this work then gets disappear when it's time for promotion, it's time for performance appraisal, because within that culture, that is not part of the job. It's not part of the things that we value. We value the bottom down, we value the money that we make. We value how many sales you have, and the fact that you develop your team and your team now is stronger and more successful. is only measuring certain ways, but all those behaviors that take time to create trust, to create, again, that safe and brave space are not part of what we value as a culture. And that's what Berdal calls a toxic, that's what Berdal calls a masculinity contest culture. So I put those two together and I started to think, you know, okay, so then maybe this is the way forward. Maybe we need to start talking about how we can embrace relational practices. How can we embrace relational leadership? Fletcher has talked a lot about it. And then adding to that, this positive organizational scholarship or positive psychology to it, because there's a group, again, at University of Michigan. Mm-hmm. The Positive Organizational Scholarship Network, where especially Jane Dutton. Mm. Notice that I'm citing a lot of women.
Yes, I love it.
And Jane Dutton talks about high-quality connections and how high-quality connections within the workplace really can create a flourishing and a more successful and a less transactional and more relational workspace where we can have a flourishing, positive social capital that everybody can benefit from. So they don't talk too much about inclusion and DEI, but it really, I think that all these three things together really can help us understand how to move forward now and stop trying to get women to behave this way or behave that way. Of course, we need spaces like this one for us to talk freely, but also we need to figure out how we can invite all those allies and, more importantly, the accomplices, because accomplices are the ones that actually take risks. The allies can be performative, right? The accomplices are accomplices in crime, right? Like they're going to take a risk. And how we make them understand that that's what we need to do together.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So that was a very long.
Oh my God, that was awesome.
I love it. I feel like I think for me and other Black, Indigenous people of color who might be tuning into this, it's cathartic to hear the work that you've been doing. Because I think that sometimes in conversations, especially when they're framed around diversity, equity, and inclusion, we lose a lot of complexity, right? And I think the work that you're doing is all about going deep into the complexities of our identities, how our identities interact, how they intersect, and then also how they do so in different contexts, right? Depending mm-hmm. on where the space you're in. If you're in academia, I think that you know that as a person of color, as someone who isn't white, as someone who isn't a man, you know these things physically, you know. And I think part of what is so important for me and what I love about talking to people like yourself and the work that you're doing is that you put language to what we feel mm-hmm. and what our bodies remember yes. about mm-hmm. these experiences, where we get that emo and we feel like, oh, there's just something wrong here. Or yeah. you have that conversation and you feel like, did anyone notice that was just a little off? Mm-hmm. There was something there. So for me, that's just like the best part of listening to you talk about your work is it's just a resounding yes, mentally, spiritually, physically. It's
right, that validation.
Like, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It's yeah. perfect.
Yeah. Yeah. And I wanted to add that, you know, the thing about language and, you know, naming things, there's this very interesting approach to organizational change that is called, I don't know if you're familiar with it, appreciative inquiry. Mm-hmm. David Cooper Ryder was a founder of it. They're in Best Western Case, Western Case University. And one thing that I always remember from going to trainings and reading about this is, words create worlds. Mm-hmm. Like it's very rooted in how we communicate and what are the things that we say. Mm-hmm. The appreciative inquiry process really helps you to, the way that he thinks about it is really like creating that safe and brave space where everybody's sitting around like tables, within different levels and different hierarchies, and you have to create a place where people feel safe to dream, discover, design and deliver new ways of doing things moving forward. And I think that that's another tool for people. If, you know, there's coaches or consultants or people that are listening to the podcast right now, like, those are tools I think that can help to create those brave and safe spaces, apart from the intergroup dialogue and appreciative inquiry. I think that those two things, because they're out of the box, they're not like, it's academic research, but it's not, most of it is based on community engaged applied research. Right. So of course there's not a a double blind randomized controlled trial to figure out how this works. So that's one of the critiques that some people use. And actually that's another, that really is another limitation for us to do the good work, especially in academia. So apart from being the director of the Center for Academic and Faculty Excellence, I'm the chair of a committee on faculty inclusive excellence. That is also, the acronym is COFFEE. I don't know if you are, you know, getting the
COFFEE,
seat,
cafe. Okay.
COFFEE and cafe. And it's because I have the two hats. So I was like, wow, you know, let's do it easy. And if they say COFFEE and means cafe, I don't care.
Okay.
It's like, yeah, talk to me. So I really am talking a lot here in this university is small. It only has 133 faculty. I'm talking about DEI all the time, right? Like if it is for DEI and trauma-informed pedagogy and equity-minded design of teaching, or if it is like, okay, we're hiring folks to come here, how do we do a hiring process that is equity-minded? Mm-hmm. And it's interesting how science and empirism and positivism really gets into the conversation and hijacks the conversation, because you may be talking about experiences, the lived experiences of people, like from a more constructivist, a more symbolic epistemology, and then they come from that more positivistic epistemology and go like, yeah, but where's the data?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Where's the case study that shows how before and after, and then it's interesting how they ask for the data is not feelings of belonging of the community. The data is not feeling engaged while doing your work as a professor in the community, or having students that are engaged and they want to stay here. The data is increased in productivity in terms of citation count. And I'm like, okay, so where do I start?
Mm-hmm.
Really, and this is again another reflection of that oppressive civility that sometimes is not even oppressive intentionally by the person who's enacting it, because they're just using their frame of reference and just imposing it on a very different scenario and a very different problem. They're just trying to put a square on a circle, and it doesn't fit, and it's very hard to have that conversation.
Right.
Because they're a square and you're a circle.
Yeah.
And it takes a lot of time to get that square to get a little bit of round edges. So you start like going like this, you're carving slowly into that square to get the round edges. You have COFFEE. During that COFFEE, you get microaggressions. You dismiss them because you are just trying to carve that. Or you get an email explaining or mansplaining what you should have done instead, and you just ignore the email and you're like, you know what, I have no spoons for this right now, and I'm going to move forward. The language, again, like the same way that we think about language to build, we were talking about how, you know, okay, we are trying to wake up, right? We're trying to get people to be woke.
Yes.
But we cannot get people to be woke if they feel threatened.
Mm-hmm.
And that's another thing that I have learned during my leadership journey, especially in terms of DEI. The moment that people feel threatened, the moment that people feel a little tiny bit of a negative emotion when you say something, they tend to disconnect.
Right.
And that's another thing that, as you know, social justice warriors or BIPOC folks we should be doing is to really, like, I know that we have a lot of work to do and this is even more work. Mm-hmm. But is the reality is that we need to use also different language. Yes. In that sense. So I was called out by a colleague of mine that I think that I'm carving the edges and mm-hmm. he's becoming an ally, hoping that at some point he will become an accomplice. Mm-hmm. And he was like, hey, in that email that you were explaining this, you said all white male professor. He's like, can you think about a different way of saying that? Because I can see, you know, in the team where we're working on this specific issue, how they can feel, you know, that they are out of the conversation, that they're blamed for this. I don't think that is the right, you know, the right language. And I wrote back, this was a whole morning of email back and forth. Mm-hmm. And I was like, okay, I fell again, like, I also have a negative reaction to it. I was like, oh my God, really? Do I have to watch my language? Like, seriously? I'm like, okay. So I answer back saying, oh yeah, I'm sorry. I usually use the term heterosexual cisgender man.
Yep.
So do you want me to change that in the email? And I'm really controlling myself here. And then this other person comes back, who's also a white man, and he was like, well, I think that still will create a problem because it's just that you're saying that, you know, they're problematic. I was referring to the fact that not everybody has a reference letter or has been recommended or is well connected with networks of all white men. So then I was like, okay, let me think about this. So what does all white men means to me? So means a person who's really connected in academia, who is in this all boys club, that knows also how things work, that is part of the system, of the power system, and it also has taught all these other people, even people of color, how to play in the system, right? Like if they have had the access to them. I'm like, okay, so I'm going to try to define this instead of saying the identity. Mm-hmm. Or how we call that identity. So I was like, okay, so people who are less connected or people who wouldn't come recommended from a person who's central and highly connected in the academe network and that has a privilege and it has identities associated with privilege. Mm-hmm. And that was the whole speech, the whole sentence to substitute the all white dude kind of thing. And I think I'd really learn a lesson here because I can say all white dude in this context, or maybe not, maybe we will edit it out.
Right.
Because that is not threatening. That doesn't create a negative effect in our conversation. Mm-hmm. But when I'm talking to people who have identities associated with privilege, especially in the academe, mm-hmm. I need to change my language again. And I am learning in this last months of my leadership journey, I'm learning so much about, you know, this importance of language and how you call things. Oh. So now, whenever I talk to faculty, I talk about privilege identities mm-hmm. or identities associated with privilege. So they really like, they know what I'm saying, mm-hmm. but also they can reflect on their own privilege mm-hmm. and think about it. I know that it's kind of code. I yes. know that from our perspective as BIPOC or underrepresented minorities, it feels disingenuous to us. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But it's helpful to continue the conversation of the squares to carve.
Yes.
So that's another insight that I have had in the last months too. You really have to figure out who's your audience.
Yeah.
Who's your team? Mm-hmm. Who's there? What is the language that you want to use? And what are the identities that are represented there? And the most complex place to be doing this is when there's an intergroup, like a group with a lot of identities. And that's why intergroup dialogue is such a great tool to create that safe and brave space where when I say white dude, the white dude in the room makes a joke.
Right.
And says, oh, come on, you're talking again about the white dude, right? Remember that, you know, like I actually grow really poor, and I will be like, oh yeah, that's true. That experience, you share that experience. So yeah, sorry about that. Yeah. So, and then, you know, like how we create this psychological safety so people don't feel backlash, but we are not there yet. Or whenever you're in a situation or a space where that psychological safety, that safe and brave space hasn't been created yet, then you have to be very careful about what are the worlds that you use, the words or the worlds, either way, that the worlds that you're creating psychologically in their mind and the with the words that you're using.
Mm-hmm. That is so right on, especially for where Jocelyn and I are and who we work with. Privilege is, that's a word that's not going to fly here.
No.
Because again, that's a trigger.
Mm-hmm.
If we think about taking DEI out and never using it, I think we would go much farther.
Yeah. And like, I love what you said, because I do agree with Jed. It's right spot on, especially for us who are working in rural areas where language is so powerful and has been used politically to convey these huge ideas or histories to people, right? When you say privilege, what all does that convey to people? This entire narrative is conveyed by one word. But as we talk about leadership, I think that is what sets it apart. If you are any person of color, if you're just someone in the general public, it's painful. And maybe you'll say, I don't want to do that. I don't want to water it down. I don't want to feel disingenuous by having to use different language or having to say it a different way. But I think for leaders, that's part of the skill set, right? And that's part of the commitment that you make as someone who steps into a leadership role, is to take on some of the things that might be a little bit more painful. Sometimes it might feel a little bit more of a struggle, but that is what makes us leaders, is the ability to have that emotional resilience, or maybe just a different way of seeing things where you can say, okay, I'm going to use this differently because I have this overall goal in my community. The people that I work with, the students that I work with are so important to me, that I'm going to take on what could be painful and could feel disingenuous, but I know it's going to help us get farther. But I think that's the thing, right? If you're a leader, you made the commitment to represent others, represent those who are following you. You made a decision to use your skill set, to use your ingenuity, your imagination to think of things differently. Mm-hmm. And that's what you have to do. That's the skill set that you have to develop. So I think that's just so powerful to me, especially for us who are working in rural areas, especially. It's just like, yep, it's true. It's hard, but it's true.
Yeah,
for sure.
And this is, it's a journey for every single person. And understanding that everybody is in a different space in the journey. I think that one thing that has helped me is to have, I have a couple of colleagues here, right? The people that talk about ADI, the people with whom you can have really honest conversations, like, can you believe I had to do this? Or can you believe I had to receive this email and went through it? And like, you know, you have different communities or different groups with whom you can be honest and you can be very, very transparent and you can be very vulnerable. But there are other places where others feel vulnerable when you are in that space. So others, and if they're in the space, it means that maybe they're trying. So, you know, I think that there's another concept from positive psychology that is compassion and self-compassion. So first of all, have self-compassion for yourself, and you don't have to go in for all the battles, and you don't have to explain everything every single time. There's very good there's very good guides on how to deal with microaggressions that I can share with you. But there's one that, you know, the first rule is, you know, check out if you have the energy to manage it or not. And it is totally okay to back off, because the most, I love the sentence, I think it says, the most important act of rebellion or of social justice is to take care of yourself. So go ahead and check if it is worth it, if you have the spoons, if you have the energy to do it. And if not, you don't have to do it. So you have to have self-compassion to yourself, for yourself. But then once you have checked, if you feel that you have the energy, that this person is worth it, that this person is in the journey and they just need a little bit of a nudge, then have compassion for them and understand that their experiences are very different from your experiences, that they are not in your shoes, and that they just need to understand what is it to feel like you're, you know, they're in your shoes or in the shoes of other people. And that perspective taking, that compassion, I know that that involves a lot of emotional labor for us. And that's why you have to think about, do I have energy to do this, right? First. So if you're going to do it well. Do it with compassion. Use a language that will not trigger backlash. Like Dali Chuck, she wrote this book, The Person You Mean to Be. It's a great book for people who wants to start being more inclusive, for people who want to be allies, for people who want to be accomplices. And instead of talking about privilege, she talks about headwinds and tailwinds. You know, just again, a different language, a different way of talking about like what has helped you in life and what has prevented you from advancing in life, because that at the end is what privilege is. Privilege is a big word when you think about it in a system, but it can be breaking down into small things when you're thinking about it at the individual level. And I think that that's one of the issues with the privilege word, is that it's very hard for people to think in this higher level, system level, because people are not sociologists. So easy to talk about this with a sociologist, but with a psychologist, and believe me, I know a lot that really like are interested on personality and very specific things about the individual, they really like just anchor themselves into that individual experience, and it's hard for them to go one level higher and understand privilege as a system and not as what were your experiences. So that idea of tailwinds and headwinds can help people to see how, you know, there may be a system, an atmospheric system that helps one way or the other, but that also some people are, you know, going in different directions or have stronger planes or different ways where they were put in their journey. So yeah, I think that compassion is a key word here. And then what I mentioned before, this idea of high quality connections, of building our relationships with other based on reciprocity. But reciprocity, as Jane Dutton explains it, is not reciprocity based on a transactional social exchange approach. It's not I do this for you, you do this for me. And this actually is a very clear, in our society here in North America, that social exchange and that transactional exchange is very rooted in our culture here. The idea that if someone does a favor for you, you feel indebted, like you feel in debt, and that you have to, you actually feel a tension, and you have to do something really fast to not to feel that you're in debt. Like here in North America, and like there's this tendency to be like that. I remember once I was helping in Canada. That's why I'm saying North America, because I didn't see a lot of difference between the States and Canada in that regard. I had a colleague who just had a baby, and their wife needed to sleep a little bit during the day. So while he was teaching, he needed somebody to be with the baby. So I volunteered. I was like, yes, of course. Like I was new. They had a baby. They had been trying for a long time. And I really like them. So I was like, of course, you know, like I can just take a couple of hours while you're teaching. And what is better than just hanging out with a baby that is cozy and you're just like this? It was a newborn. It was so cute. But I, you know, from my Spanish culture, I was trying to build community. You know, I was trying to create a meaningful relationship with them through providing instrumental support, but also an instrumental support that is not just, I'm going to go make a lasagna and leave it at your door. I'm going to spend quality time with your son. So then after that semester happened and, you know, things went better for them, they just gave me they gave me a very nice gift, a massage that I went and I got, and it was super nice. And then a couple of months later, the first year birthday of the kid came up, but I didn't get invited, right? Because for them, and this is not that they're bad people, I'm just giving this as an example of how in our culture and how it's kind of like, again, like culture and that foundation and that roots, those very, very rooted assumptions work and don't allow us to move forward. Is that in their culture, it was like, okay, they did a favor for us. We're in debt. We really want to solve the question. We will get them something very nice. And that's it. It's like, I don't know, with weddings, like all these, you know, like thank you notes and everything. And it's like, I don't want a thank you note. I want to have a coffee with you after going to the wedding. Like, I want to, you know, I want to see, you know, your family. I want to connect with you. So that is what reciprocity is. Reciprocity is connection, creating a link. It's like creating an hyperlink, but an hyperlink that goes two ways, that you're always connected to that other person and that you are really interested on the growth of the other person and the development and vice versa. And it has to be the vice versa. Like this reciprocity has to go both ways, because if not, you just have this type of motherly love that, yeah, it's very feminine, but it's also very like emotionally exhausting. So the idea is that you give and you get, but not in a transactional way. Like there's no tension when somebody does something for you, because you know that it will come back maybe from that person, but also it may come back from like 2 degrees of connection later with something else. So when we think about that, when we're doing the DEI work and we're enacting our leadership practice for more equity-minded perspective, then we start to see like, okay, well, it's going to be hard to have a coffee with this person that has identities associated with privilege, right? I may get some microaggressions during the coffee. Or I may feel that I'm disrespected at my professional level, or that they're going to question my expertise, or that they're going to make a comment about how young I look or things like that. But this person wants to have a coffee with me. They want to have a conversation, and I can learn from that. I actually can learn what are the paths of thinking. How do they think about these things in order to, for the next coffee with that person or another person, I'm ready for going into that path of conversation and argument. Like, you know, like you have to do the work, especially if you want to be a leader on this. And not everybody has to be a leader. Again, compassion and, you know, self-care is a main act of protest. I have to remember what the sentence is. I will give you the link to that. To that paper. It's an HBR paper by two women of color talking about how to deal with microaggressions. Is wonderful. So yeah, I think that is very important. And I'm enjoying having this conversation because I'm reflecting on my own leadership practice. And it's really interesting to think about this way.
Yeah, and I am so thankful that you have brought up that self-care. You know, we see that, I'm sure you're familiar with the book Presumed Incompetent was
No.
written. Oh,
oh my God, I have
I
to
should
look
have
at it.
Bought it. It's presumed incompetent.
Oh my
God. And it is of color. Oh, are you looking at it right now?
Yes.
Yes. It's amazing because it is, again, going back to that validation that sometimes I think really comes from that collective. We have that foundation that is so similar among us. And so hearing the stories and, like you were saying, Jocelyn, getting that even visceral reaction of, oh my God, I've been through that. I hear you. I understand it. And at the same time, knowing that in our journeys, whether you're going to be a leader who is forefront or you're going to be a leader within your sphere of influence, taking care of that self and knowing that without you, there isn't going to be that perspective. Mm-hmm. I think that is, I found for myself, that's the hardest balance. Even, mm-hmm. you know, in my research with civility in academia, you can become so ingrained in that system and become so used to the microaggressions. It's the norm.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so how do we find a balance, especially when we're seeing folks get lost?
Yeah. I think that there's different ways. I think that one way is building communities where, or finding the communities where there's less of that. And finding the people that are, you know, ready to listen, that in their journey, they're ready.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Instead of trying to talk to people that are not ready to listen and spending time and energy on that.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause sometimes you need people that are ready to listen, and then those people will be telling other, so that there's this proximal, like maybe they will not listen to you, but maybe they will listen to another person, right?
Yes. That power mapping. Yeah, I love that idea. Yeah.
Exactly. So thinking about impact in a more cumulative way. Mm-hmm. And again, academia and our frames of reference come back here again. In academia, we think about impact in terms of like how many citations you have, right? Citations you have. Which journals did you publish in that have like this impact index? How many papers do you have? It's about quantity. And the reason why it's quantity is because from my perspective as a organizational theorist, is because we as humans have what we call, Kahneman call bounded rationality. And that means that we cannot make decisions that are totally rational, because we actually as humans don't have the ability to process all the information that is out there. So because we are rationally bounded, we will never be able to make complex decisions or be able to, for example, when you look at a CV of a fellow colleague, you don't have the time or the energy or maybe the knowledge to read all their papers to really understand what their scholarly contribution is. So what do? We take a shortcut and we just count, right? And we just look at, you know, how many impact, like what is the impact index of the journals where they go. And that's why, for example, in my cover letters or whenever I do a statement of research, I explain why I publish in the papers and the journals where I publish, that I actually am more interested about readership that is interested on what I'm doing than a journal that has a higher impact index, but nobody's going to read my stuff or even like, you know, consider it. So then what happens is that this frame of reference of in academia about quantity, about more is better and higher is better, then comes back to understanding our relationships in academia and how we relate to each other. So when you have someone that is a square with those carved, rounded edges, that person can help understand the other person that is a square better what is going on than you being a circle and not having the spoons or the energy to get the square to understand, or to get the square, not even to understand, to get the square to do a little bit of perspective taking. That's it. You don't have to convince anybody. It's your perspective taking. So I think that the idea of, you know, mapping who is in the journey and how they can, you know, like you can do a line and put them there and going like, okay, so if I convince this person will talk to this person, and then they move them into that journey a little bit in the other direction, could be helpful. I know people that, for example, I love politics in the organization and in the academia. I have been a student. I was a student representative all my life. Like when I was an undergrad, when I was a grad, like I always have been like really involved in politics. So I find them really fun, to be honest. Like I love, especially having suffered the politics in Spain. When I come here, I'm like, oh my God, you're amateurs. You don't know what it is to be nasty in academia. Like there's stronger systems of oppression in academia. And I think that maybe it's because they are like a little bit more like less subtle. That's probably why. So I am having fun, you know, having these leadership positions at the university, because I feel that I have the spoons, I have the tools, I have the competence, I have the expertise and as an organizational psychology to kind of navigate that. But that doesn't mean that everybody can do that or wants to do that. No, probably they can. It's just that, do they want to do it? Do they want to actually enjoy it while they're doing it and while they're getting all the microaggressions? So find the pockets or the places where you actually want to do the work. And a little bit of work is going to help, because again, also this idea of that things have to be like very impactful. We have to forget about that. Science really is about the accumulation in academia and scholarship, accumulation of little tiny things over time, right? Like when I was talking about how I'm thinking about things, I'm talking about like 3-4 different women that have inspired me into the type of theories that I'm, that are like brewing in my mind right now. Is not one single person that has, and they have come from, like all the research also cites other people, right? Like, so it's all cumulative. So same thing, leadership, social justice work can be cumulative, and it can be small and can be a little tiny contribution, but it will accumulate, it will get there. It will take a long time, but.
Yeah. Thank you. I think that's a good place. I think that's a perfect wrap-up of the conversation. Yes. Is there anything else that you would like to mention? Any other statement that you would like to make that you want to include?
Yes. Self-care is the most important act of resistance.
Mm-hmm.
I finally remembered what it was. Yeah. But I will send you the paper, because I want to cite who really said that. It wasn't me.
Yeah.
Like everything that I say here is not that I don't think that I have came up with any of that. I have came up with a way of reflecting on it in my leadership practice, really. So I think that the last thing to say is that in order to do self-care, there has to be reflection.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that taking the time to reflect on what are you doing? Why are you doing it?
Mm-hmm.
With whom are you doing it? I think it's important to do that every now and then.
Mm-hmm.
to check with yourself, see how many spoons you have,
mm-hmm.
and see in which direction you want to continue being a leader in the community or in the communities where you are. Where do you want to be a follower?
Right.
Where do you want to support others? Where do you want to be an ally?
Mm-hmm.
Where are you willing to take risks and really become an accomplice. Mm-hmm. Accomplice. So yeah, reflect. I think reflecting is a good way of ending.
Thank you so much, Gloria, for being here today. We had an amazing conversation, and I think that the insights that you've shared have just been so, so valuable, and so, it's like pressure, really, yeah, to have these conversations. So thank you once again for being here and joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. This was really fun, and I'm going to be taking notes once the podcast is out, and maybe write something to spread it a little bit more.